For every one of us in life, I think that sometimes life becomes a dead-end street when we fail to reach certain goals that we have set for ourselves. And everybody has different goals that we set for ourselves. And we are disappointed because we haven't arrived or achieved. And then secondly, we reach our goals, but we do not feel that those goals are fulfilling. You ever had that experience? Either, first of all, you have a goal and you don't reach it and you're frustrated and you think, gee, you know, why try? Or you reach your goal, you achieve what you've been going for, and then you realize that it's all emptiness. When Solomon used the idea of emptiness or vanity, same thing, he was likening life unto a soap bubble. And it's just that nothingness. You ever seen a soap bubble come up maybe off a, you know, tub of suds or something, and you poke it with your finger and pops, and then it's just nothing. It's gone. It disappears. I like to get out in the front yard with the kids and do the little bubbles, you know, where you blow through the thing and the bubbles go, or you just kind of swish it through the air and all the bubbles go streaming out and the kids go running after it. And especially Jared, he has a blast doing that. And he'll chase a bubble and he'll just about get that bubble, you know, pop, and just, oh, it's gone. It's nothing, you know. Why am I chasing these silly things? You know, I run all the way across the yard and almost get it, and it's gone. It's nothing. Well, that's the way life is for a lot of people. It's like a dead-end street. It's like you spend your whole life chasing these little bubbles, and then when you finally get them, they pop, and there's really no substance there to them. In the Bible, there are several people, great men of God, who several places in their lives were greatly discouraged and felt that their lives were a dead-end street. I think of Moses in Numbers 11, who asked God to take his life. He wanted to die and wished that he'd never been born. Now, we think of Moses as some great spiritual leader. Wow, what a great guy, Moses. But he, like you and I, had a time when he said, man, I wish I could just die. I wish I was never born. We all come to those places. And then Elijah in 1 Kings chapter 19, hiding under the juniper tree from the wicked Queen Jezebel, wishing that he could die, wishing that he could just, you know, cease to be. And then there's also the story of Jeremiah, chapter 8, chapter 15. Jeremiah wished he'd never been born. Jeremiah, by the way, had one of the saddest lives and ministries that any prophet of God could ever have. He spent a lifetime preaching and didn't get one convert. How's that for success in life? Nobody believed him. Finally, he was taken at the end of his life as a captive, in a sense, to Egypt, and he died there. It wasn't until after Jeremiah died that people began to realize that he was a great man of God. You ever feel like some people are never going to really appreciate you till you're dead and gone? So you tell them, you know, you ought to appreciate me right now. There's going to come a day when I won't be around and you'll really see what a great guy I was. And Jeremiah had a real sad life. You can read his book of Lamentations. We have a book in the Bible written by Jeremiah where all he did was lament and weep. He was so discouraged. He felt like his life was just a dead-end street. And then there's also Jonah. How Jonah felt like he was a failure and he wanted to die. Here, I'm preaching to the enemies of Israel and they repent and God spares them. And Jonah thought, Lord, just kill me. If I go back home and they find out what I've done, my career is over anyway. And did you know that even the great Paul the Apostle, and I've been falling in love with Paul all over again, as we've studied the book of Acts, that even Paul the Apostle in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 said that he despaired even of life. That Paul got so low and so discouraged that he despaired even of life. Now, life confronts us with many mysteries. And Solomon in the 6th chapter is going to deal with those mysteries, or deal with the person that feels like, I'm a failure, life's a dead-end street. You know, and it just, life isn't working for me. It's just not happening. Now, this is not a bad process for us to go through. Many times we have to begin to evaluate life and why am I here and where am I going, to seek to come to a realization, I need God in my life. I believe that without God, life is without purpose and life is without meaning. If there is no God, there really is no purpose and there really is no meaning in life. Life is just purposeless. Life is just empty without God. And so Solomon, the preacher, is going to be dealing with these mysteries that confront us. We feel like life is passing us by and we're not finding the purpose and the real meaning in life. Life is not satisfying. It doesn't make sense. We get frustrated. We start to question God and we even begin to wonder if life is really even worthwhile. If I should even be living life. And so Solomon does it in asking three questions, or really in three statements, and then closing with his questions in verses 10 and 12. Solomon discussed three of life's mysteries. Now there's more than three mysteries in life, but Solomon discusses three of these life mysteries. The first one is in verses 1 to 6, and that is, the mystery of the person who has riches but does not have enjoyment. There are a lot of people in this world that have wealth, but they do not have the gift of God to enjoy them, or they do not have the capacity from God to enjoy them. So the first mystery of life that really creates life as a dead-end street, or brings me to the place that life is a dead-end street, is this idea that I can have riches, but many times I do not enjoy them. Verse 1. Solomon says, there is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men. And this is so true. He says in verse 2, that a man to whom God giveth riches and wealth and honor. Three great things. I'd like to have riches, wealth, and honor. So that he wanteth nothing for his soul. Of all that he desireth, yet, here's the crux, God giveth him not power to eat thereof, but a stranger eateth it. This is emptiness, and it is an evil disease. If a man begats 100 children and live for many years, now Solomon's saying that in a good sense. Today you think, oh Lord, spare me. Now, I do believe that he's speaking hypothetically here. No monogamous relationship can produce 100 children. It's just biologically impossible. You'd have to have a polygamous relationship. And how interesting that Solomon said that. He had 700 wives. Now, you can put out a lot of kids with 700 wives. You know, you walk into the room, there's 30 kids, you know, and are those mine? Oh, I didn't know that, you know, and you got all these kids, you know. Imagine that. But in this culture at this time, one of the greatest evidences of a blessed life and God's blessings on your life were children. Two things that everyone looked for, a lot of kids and a lot of wealth. If you had a lot of wealth and a large family, man, you were happening. You were blessed of God. And that was the culture that they lived in at that time. So he says, you know, even if a guy lives a long life and he has 100 kids, so that the days of his years be many and his soul is not filled with good, also he has no burial. In other words, he dies and nobody even loves him. Nobody even cares about him. He just buried, no funeral. I say that an untimely birth is better than he. For he cometh in with vanity, and he departeth in darkness, and his name shall be covered with darkness. Moreover, he hath not seen the sun, nor known anything. This hath more rest than the other. Yea, though he live 1,000 years, twice told, 2,000 years. Again, we're speaking hypothetically here. No one has ever lived 2,000 years. Solomon's just getting the idea of long life. If he lives for 2,000 years and hath seen no good, do not all go to one place? Solomon asked. Now, basically what Solomon is saying here is that there is a mystery to me about life, in that some people have a lot of children, a lot of wealth, and they have a long life, and they seem to have everything going for them, but yet they never really have enjoyment. They never really enjoy life. Think about Howard Hughes. What a wealthy guy he was, but he lived the life of a recluse. I think the guy lost his marbles, matter of fact. You know, he was afraid to be seen in public. He's afraid for anyone to see him or to know where he was or what he was doing, and live somewhere in isolation, away from people. And what a horrible thing. There are a lot of people like that today. We envy movie stars, and we envy millionaires and billionaires. Actually, millionaires are dime a dozen today, but I mean, you know, these multi-billionaires and these rich people and these famous people, we think, oh yeah, that's where it's at. That does not guarantee enjoyment of life. Well, if I had that house, I'd be really enjoying life. You might be hating life. Man, if I had that car, I would just be enjoying life, you know. If I had that husband, if I had that wife, I'd be enjoying life. No, you wouldn't be. Boy, if I could just do this or I could just have that, I'd be enjoying life. No guarantee is what Solomon says. Now, as you look at these verses, he says, first of all, that this is an evil that is common. He says, a man whom God will give riches and wealth and honor, nothing that his soul would desire, yet God gives him not power to eat thereof, but a stranger eats it. Now, what he's basically saying is, for some reason, this guy has all this material wealth, but he doesn't have the capacity to enjoy it. Now, we don't know specifically what the issue was. It could have been sickness. How many guys will labor all their life and make a whole lot of money, and then whammo, they're struck with some sickness? Maybe they have a stroke. I know a fellow recently that had a stroke. Very well off, non-Christian man, very proud man. A lot of possessions, a lot of earthly wealth. Self-made man that's very proud, and he had a stroke. Now he is basically an invalid. He has to be cared for and taken care of, and he's wanting to kill himself. Has all this wealth, but he can't enjoy it. I've always said that if you're not a Christian, you better hope you don't get real sick or get maimed or have horrible things happen to you. You better hope you can have lots of money and everything goes smooth in life, because that's all you are going to get. That's where it all is at. So you better hope that's what you're going to get. Or maybe he works all his life and looks forward to his retirement years. You know, I'm not banking on my retirement years. Matter of fact, if the Lord so wills, I hope and pray I can preach until I just drop. Or I get so boring, everyone says, we've got to get rid of John Miller. This guy's just over the hill. But you know, you don't retire in the Lord's work, and I don't plan on doing that. But a lot of people look forward to the retirement years, you know. Got my little nest egg, and I got my little RV, and boy, my wife and I, you know, finally the kids are gone, and we're just going to, you know, go out and really have a good time. And then again, whammo, some sickness happens, and all your money goes to pay medical bills. You lose it all. Or you lose your health. Or you lose your wife. Or you lose your husband. You don't know what it might be that can keep you from really enjoying that which you think you're going to derive pleasure from. You never know. If your life consists of things and finding pleasure in things, then you really can't say that your life has purpose or fulfillment or meaning. Then he says in verse 3, if a man begat 100 children and live many years, so that the days of his years be many and his soul be not filled with good, and also that he have no burial. So This guy had a large family, but guess what? He wasn't loved. And that's no big deal either. You have a lot of kids, you have, you know, a wife. The issue is, are you really loved? This guy had wealth, he couldn't enjoy it. He had children, he couldn't enjoy them. They didn't really care about him. He says it would be better that he had an untimely birth. The idea there is of a stillborn child, that he'd been born dead. End of verse 3. For the reason that it had been better that he be born dead, verse 4, for he cometh in with emptiness. He would have come in, he comes in with emptiness, and he departs in darkness. His name will be covered with darkness. He would have never been given a name. The Jews did not give stillborn children names. When a baby was born dead, the Jews did not give the baby a name. They felt like it would help the parents to recover more quickly over the tragedy and the heartbreak of the thing. And so it was an unknown baby or unnamed baby. Today, we name them and we have funeral services and we consider them still one of our children that we've lost or gone to heaven, actually, not lost, but gone to be with the Lord. And so this Solomon looking, verse 1, at life under the sun, which is life without God. Life without God in the center of it, says it'd be better that you'd have actually been born dead. I think of the rich fool that Jesus talked about in Luke chapter 12. And he had one year a bumper crop. He was a farmer and he had all this wealth. And he said, wherein shall I bestow all my goods? He said, I know what I'll do. I'll build bigger barns, big, great big barns, and I'll store all my grain in these big, beautiful barns. And then I'll say to my soul, soul, take thine ease, eat, drink, for thou hast much goods laid up for thee for many years. Oh, this guy thought, finally I'm set. Retirement time. And he went to bed that night with big plans for the future. And that night God said, thou fool, this very night your soul shall be required of thee. Then who shall all those things be which thou hast provided? Think about that. He has to leave it all behind and he has to give it to somebody who didn't work for it. Notice it says here that he leaves it to a stranger. This guy wasn't even able to give it to his family. A stranger, the state comes in or somebody else comes in and they take all of his money. I mean, just go walking around looking at all your possessions and then think someday somebody you don't even know is just going to take it all. Vanity of vanities, all is vanities. Now, I believe that you cannot truly enjoy the gifts of God apart from the God who gives the gifts. You cannot truly, and I underline the word truly, enjoy the gifts from God apart from the God of the gifts. The things that God gives us in life cannot really be enjoyed unless we have a relationship with the giver of the gifts. We know that even on a human level, that sometimes the gift that is given isn't all that exciting, but it's the kind of love and the motive and the relationship that's developed in the person that gives to me and the receiving of it. Christmas time, you get gifts and you go, they're not that excited, but it's neat that people care. It's neat that people share. And, you know, it's the thought that matters, you know, when you open those gifts and they're not all that exciting and, oh, well, it's the thought that matters. Our flesh is hoping for some real groovy thing that we can get into, you know. But often we're disappointed, but it's the thought that matters. It's that relationship to God. Well, with God, He does give good gifts, wonderful gifts. And it's the thought that matters. He loves us. And it's a relationship with Him. God can give you children. God can give you wealth. God can give you health. God can give you a great marriage. God can give you a ministry. God can give you fame and all those things. But if you don't have God, so what? Big deal. And that's really what Solomon's saying. He's saying it's really all kind of empty and all kind of vain. I like what Warren Worsby said. He said, enjoyment without God is merely entertainment, and it doesn't satisfy. But enjoyment with God is enrichment, and it brings true joy and satisfaction. I like that. You know, I've often evaluated that. I don't understand Christians that have to be constantly entertained. They come to church and they feel like they need to be entertained. Well, you know, let's hear the choir give a stirring rendition and let's see a movie and, you know, why, well, how about not preach tonight and have a juggling bear? And they like to go to churches where there's a lot of entertainment. I know that there are people who come in here and plop down on a Sunday night, Sunday morning, Wednesday night, and they think that there's going to be some really exciting, far out, fantastic, happening thing go on, and then I get up. And I talk for an hour. And they think, man, my... You know what? It's sore and I'm tired and this guy's just blabbing and man, you know, where's the movie? Where's the band, man? Where's the juggling bear? Where's the excitement? Where's the choir? Where's the orchestra? Where's the drama? And they're not really all that, you know, entertained. A lot of churches cater to people's entertainment or Christian society. I remember when contemporary Christian music first came out and then started kind of getting off into some groups started getting off into other areas, you know, and people started questioning the validity of, is it ministering? And I heard a lot of Christians crying, well, what's wrong with Christian entertainment? You ever heard that before? Christian entertainment. What, pray tell me, is Christian entertainment? You know, a clown with a fish on it or something? That's a Christian entertainer or something. I don't know. What is Christian entertainment anyway? I don't know. Why do we need to be entertained? Why do we need to be pizzazz and jazz and all that kind of stuff? Because what has happened is we want entertainment, but we don't want really enrichment. Enrichment brings true joy and true happiness. And enrichment... And I'm kind of sad that we're not going to go too far into chapter 7 tonight, but hang in there because chapter 7 gives an opposite side of the coin of chapter 6. Chapter 7 says that adversity is not always bad. Chapter 6 says prosperity is not always good. That's what those two chapters say. Chapter 6 of Ecclesiastes says prosperity is not always good. Chapter 7 says adversity is not always bad. That's what those two chapters say in a nutshell. And what I'm saying is that for us as Christians, that God wants to enrich our lives, not entertain our lives. Because He wants us to have true joy. And some of the richest experiences in life are the fruit of sorrow. That's why in chapter 4 He said it's better to go to the house of mourning than it is to go to the party and laugh and giggle and goof off all night. It's better to go to a funeral than it is to go to a party. That's not what the world says. Adversity enriches life in a way that entertainment cannot. The sad thing is that we're Christians, we're buying the world's goods that, you know, we have to be entertained. And we are the shallower because of it. Actually, when we seek entertainment rather than enrichment, we start to live on cheap substitutes. We start to live on substitutes and our lives become really empty and our lives become phony and hollow rather than living on the real thing. So, Solomon is telling us here that there are those who have riches, but they do not enjoy them, and it puzzled him. He couldn't understand that. The answer is, by the way, before we move on, is that we ought to plan to live now instead of start living later. When I get, when I have, someday. In other words, live now. Don't plan one day to start living. Live now. That's one of the conclusions that Solomon comes to. It's not an eat, drink, and be merry philosophy, but it's just enjoy life now, is what he's saying. In a sense of, these are gifts from God. These are enrichments from God. These are pleasures that God gives us. Enjoy them now to the fullest. And that the ability to enjoy life comes from God living within us, and it is a matter of character, not circumstances. The ability to enjoy life comes from God, and from Him specifically living in us. And enjoying life is a matter of character. It's not a matter of our circumstances that surround us. Paul the Apostle is a great example in Philippians chapter 4. When he wrote that, he was where? He was in prison in Rome. Now, technically, he was in a hired house, but he was still in chains. But Paul wrote to the Philippians, and he said, I've learned in whatever state I am in, therewith to be content. I know how to abase, I know how to abound, I know how to suffer need, I know in all things. For I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me. You know the word content means inner sufficient, inner contained. The word content means self-contained. It means that I don't need a shot of alcohol. It means I don't need to smoke dope or shoot dope or whatever it might be. It means that, you know, I don't need 3 trips to Disneyland every year to be a happy person. And throw a Magic Mountain in there too. And if you got time, Knott's Berry Farm and SeaWorld would be great too. And a few Christian concerts that are entertaining. And I'm a happy, fulfilled, joyful Christian. It means that I can be sitting in a prison with chains on my wrist and content. Even though I have no television and VCR, I've learned to be content in whatever state I'm in. Paul said that, and there were no video stores in those days. How could he possibly be content? There were no amusement parks in Rome. Amazing. Because his contentment came from Christ dwelling within. I like to think of it as these self-contained recreation vehicles. You know, the real nice, big, giant, self-contained recreation vehicles that have every amenity that you can imagine, and they go out in the wilderness and rough it. They're out there with their antennas stuck up, you know, and their big dishes, you know, and their microwave ovens and their beds, you know, and their showers and bathrooms, and they're self-contained. All around them could be a desolate wilderness, but man, they're having a grand time inside there because they have everything they need. They're self-contained. That's what the idea is. I have learned to be content. I don't need that fix. I don't need that prop. I have the Lord to draw from. It's that artesian well, the Holy Spirit, as I drink of Him from within. So, the key is having Christ dwelling within. Now, the second one that mystified Solomon is in verses 7 through 9. And that is labor without satisfaction. Now, first he dealt with a rich man. He had wealth without pleasure. The second man is a laboring man, but he's never satisfied. He works and he works and he works, but he never really has satisfaction in life. Verse 7, all the labor of a man or man is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not filled. How true that is. For what hath the wise more than the fool? What hath the poor that knoweth to walk before the living? The answer is nothing, none. What hath the wise more than the fool? Nothing. They both actually go to the same place, as Solomon goes on to say. He says, better is the sight of the eyes, verse 9, than the wandering of desire. This is also vanity and vexation of spirit. Now, Solomon says in verse 7, basically, that we work to eat and we eat to live. And the conclusion is, why should I eat to live if there is no living in my life? You got that? Have you ever thought about that? You go, no, I'm just having a great time going to Disneyland. That's all I want to do. You know, as I've been reading Ecclesiastes this week, again, I've thought about how people that are not Christians so often, they don't want to really think about real issues of life. Do you know, we call them amusement parks, and I'll get off of this in a minute. I'm not really, I do go to Disneyland once in a while, but we call them amusement parks. The word muse means to think. The negative prefix in front of it is amuse, means not to think. So let's just forget our worries and let's forget our cares. Let's go be amused and go to Disneyland, you know. Let's not think about the bills. Let's go spend more money. We'll just put it on the Visa, not think about it. And then when the bill comes, then we'll think. But that's what they are. They're amusement parks. Don't think, don't worry, just have a good time. And I think that's what Walt Disney's really goal was for people just to come there and forget their worries, forget their cares, live in a make-believe world, you know, where everything's just lovely and everything's freshly painted and looks so nice and there's no trash anywhere. And, oh, wow, this is just neat, you know. Let's live here. That's not real. And you really get this again in the seventh chapter where he talks about it's better to go to the house of mourning than to be in the house of laughter. You know, people don't want to go to funerals. You ever know a non-Christian that loves to go to funerals? Or even a Christian, but yet a I see it. When I do a funeral, I can tell the difference between a Christian and a non-Christian, the way they can face death. One of the most harsh realities of life is death, and the world doesn't want to think about it. They want to run from it. They want to just avoid it at all costs. That's kind of what Solomon is talking about, you know, that we get into this thought of, why do I work? Well, I work to make money. Why do I need money? So I can buy food. Why do I buy food? So I can eat. Why do I eat? So I can live. Why do I live? I don't know. Kind of bummed out, miserable, depressed, you know? And you know people, when they get discouraged, bummed out, or get into these great depressions, they don't want to eat. Well, I don't want to live. But stop and think about it. Is there any life during life? You know, everybody says, is there life after death? I want to know, is there any life during life? What is life all about? Why live? He says there in verse 7 that all the labor of man is for his mouth. You just eat everything you work for. But yet the appetite is not filled. What advantage do we have in all our work? You see, the problem for many is that the law of life is first self-preservation, me first mentality. If a human being lives with that philosophy, me first, self-preservation, he's living on a lower level than God, who made man in his image and likeness, intended him to live. You see, we were made as human beings to live on a higher plane. We were made for eternity. We were made to enjoy God. We were made to know God and enjoy Him forever. God never made man for material things to bring him his primary joy and pleasure in life, but that man might have fellowship with God. And when we are not in fellowship with God and we do not know God, then we're really missing the whole boat. It's that simple. You're not living on the highest plane that God intended man to live on, who was made in the image and in the likeness of God. It's me first, instead of God first and serving others. Interesting that Jesus said, if you want to find life, what did he say to do? He said, lose it. He said, if you want to lose life, what do? Find it. That is the antithesis of what the world says. You want to really live? Make money. You want to really live? Be a playboy. You want to really live? Be a star. Be famous. Be a sports hero. Or whatever they promote. You know, this is what you do if you really want to live.
You know, do what you want to do. Live for yourself. Follow your dreams. Do it your way, Frank Sinatra used to say. Jesus said, hey, you're going to miss the boat altogether. You're going to completely miss life. For those who feel that self-preservation is really the first rule of life, the truth is, it's the first rule of death. The first rule of life is death. Me last, Jesus first, others second. Deny yourself and follow me, Jesus said. I remember as a young man, I was 19 years old when I finally surrendered my life really to follow Jesus Christ. I was 19. And those verses really hit me so hard. If you want to live, die. If you want to die, live for yourself. I realized that I had to, even as a young 19-year-old kid, I realized I had to give my life up. My wants, my goals, my desires, my ambitions, and say, Lord Jesus, I die to myself. I give it to you. And that was when I began to live. 19 years old, and I didn't begin to live until that day. And finally I said, Lord, I die to myself. I give my life to you. And that's when I found life. Solomon then in verse 8, he says, for what hath the wise more than the fool? What hath the poor that knoweth to walketh before the living? There must be more to life is what Solomon's saying there. There must be something greater than ourselves to live for. And that is true. There must be something better than us to live for. Someone said, in America, we have devised improved means to unimproved ends. I like that. We have devised improved means to unimproved ends. Think about how fantastic our communication systems are in the world today. Unbelievable. You know, and I can carry a phone anywhere I want, and I can talk to somebody on a phone, and now I can punch a phone out of the seat in front of me on an airplane, and I can be cruising over the Atlantic at 30,000 feet and call my kids up at home and say, how you doing? This is Dad. And we can call around the world, and we have facsimile machines, and we can fax people on the other side of the world, and they get it just a few seconds later, and they can fax us back, and just unbelievable. But, you know, we have developed as fantastic means of communication, but we don't have anything good to say. We have nothing better to say than mankind had 2,000 years ago. We have a better way to say it, you know, we can communicate, but we don't have anything better to say. We have nothing better to say today than when Paul and Luke and Timothy and Silas went trucking around the continent of Asia Minor, Macedonia. They knew what life was about. They didn't need this enlightened age to know what life was about. They knew. They didn't have all the modern gadgets we had, but today we have nothing better to say. I think of television. What a fantastic medium television is. We can watch live the Olympics going on the other side of the world. Isn't that fantastic? But again, what's on the screen so much? Sin, corruption, violence, wickedness, moral decay. Wow, we got this really great new thing. It's called television. Now we can communicate sin through the medium of television. You know, man hasn't improved himself morally one bit. We just have devised improved means to unimproved ends. In verse 9, he says, better is the sight of the eye than the wandering of desire. You know what that is today in the modern vernacular? That is, better is a bird in the hand than two in the bush. That's exactly what he's saying. He's saying, better is a bird in the hand than two in the bush. Now, he's not saying that desires are wrong or that we should not have ambition to accomplish something in life. But he is saying that our ambitions should be God-centered. As he comes to the conclusion of the book, he says, remember thy Creator now in the days of thy youth, He talks about fearing God, honoring Him, obeying His commandments. Nothing wrong with having ambition and having goals in life. The question is what place does God play in your goal and your ambition? And whose glory are you seeking? You see, we need to first of all have ambitions that will bring glory and honor to God. We need to ask ourselves tonight, what is my ambition? What is my goal with my life? What do I want to do with my life? If the motive for your ambition is not the glory of God, you will miss life. If the motive for your ambition is your glory, your honor, then you will miss life. A second thing is that our desires need to be others-centered, not to promote ourselves. First, the glory of God should be a foundation for our desires and motives. And secondly, the desire to serve and be a blessing and a benefit to others. Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to Thee. Take my silver, take my gold, not a mite will I withhold. Take my hands, take my mouth, take my feet. We should desire God to just use us for His glory and for the benefit of others. That's a worthy goal and ambition that will find life. And then thirdly, true satisfaction comes from doing the will of God from the heart. True satisfaction comes from doing the will of God from the heart. I'm drawing conclusions here from what Solomon has said. He here is looking at life just under the sun, but the answer to those things are the points that I just gave you. Now, in verse 10 to 12, Solomon closes with the third mystery of life, and that is questions without answers. We see people who have riches, but they do not enjoy them. We see people who labor, but have no satisfaction. And then Solomon closes with these questions that we all often have in life, but there seems to be no answers. Now, life for the person who has to have answers to everything is going to be a dead-end street. If he thinks that all of life's mysteries have to be answered, then certainly life is going to be empty and frustrating for him. Notice in verse 10, Solomon starts, he says, "That which hath been is named already, and is known that it is man. Neither may he contend with him that is mightier than he. Seeing there be many things that increase emptiness, what is man the better? For, verse 12, who knoweth what is good for man in this life? All the days of his vain life which he spendeth as a shadow, for who can tell a man what is after him under the sun, or what be after him under the sun?" There are five questions in these verses. Five questions that Solomon proposes. Now, he's not saying that we can't have honest inquiry and honest searching to life's questions. But what he is saying is that not all the questions of life can be answered. I would be a fool to tell you that I could answer all the mysteries of life. Any question that you have, I could answer. No, I can't. God hasn't answered them. God has withheld many things from us. Now, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, we see through a glass darkly, a mirror. We don't see clearly in that mirror. But one day we will see all things clearly. One day we'll see God face to face, and we will know even as we are known. There are many things we don't understand. But what we need to know to enjoy life, to find satisfaction, to true happiness, God has given to us. Did you catch that? The things that God hasn't revealed aren't things that I need to have a happy life. You ever meet somebody that's bitter and cynical and angry at God and at life because some tragedy took place in their life and they didn't understand why? Sure. I don't know why God. And they will hang on to that why to their dying day in bitterness. I don't know why this. I don't know why that. You say, John, are we supposed to go through life and ask no questions? No. If God answers them, we know why. If God doesn't answer them, you know how we're supposed to live? By faith in God and in His promises. The Bible says the just shall live by faith.
I don't know why God either. I don't know why that happened or why this happened or why God allowed that. But you know something? God has told me something about the future, and He has given me some promises that I can hang on to. I know all things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to His purpose. And I may not see that good in this life. It may be in the by and by. It may be on the other side. Maybe on heaven's side. I don't know. But I'm going to trust God by faith, and I'm going to rest in His promises. That's the only way you can go through life without becoming bitter or cynical or angry or frustrated and really enjoy life, is to walk by faith and to trust that God understands why. We're looking at the tapestry from the wrong side. We see all the threads that make no sense and have no pattern, and the colors all seem to be smeared together, but God's weaving a tapestry of our life from the other side, and when we get over there, then we'll see. Now we'll understand when God takes us to be with Him. Now let me kind of rephrase these questions. Five of them, we'll rip through them real quick, that Solomon gives in closing. The first one in verse 10, the first part of verse 10, Solomon says, since what's going to be is going to be, why bother to make decisions? Isn't it all predestined anyway? Have you ever thought about that? Now you gotta put your thinking caps on and hang with me as we wrap up here. Solomon's basically saying, if what is going to be, God is sovereign. And God's, you know, ruling over the affairs of man. If what is going to be, why make any decisions? Why not just blob out? God knows it's going to happen before it's going to happen. Now, this comes from verse 10. And what it says in verse 10 is, that which hath been is named already and is known that it is man. A paraphrase of that, the NIV actually translates that, whatever exists has already been named, and what man is has been known. Now, the thing is in the Hebrew mind, whenever they attached a name to something, they were also giving that thing its character. It touches on what Gail said this morning about Jacob. His name was Jacob, heel catcher, supplanter. He gave us a big free paraphrase. Dirty, stinking thief. That was a liberal paraphrase. But, you know, as his name is, so is he. And that's what the Hebrews were into, naming people to indicate their character. I remember as a young man going to church and introducing myself to some of the old timers and telling, my name's John. Oh, that's a great name. Live up to it. My middle name is Paul. They'd say, that's a great name. Live up to it. And it's neat if your name can kind of indicate your character, but it doesn't always work that way. But then the whole Hebrew culture is when God names something or they name something, it's putting the character and the destiny on that person. And that's what it means here in the 10th verse when it says, that which hath been is named already. What you are, God has already named you. God has already stated. God has already made you what you're going to be. So why make any decisions? Now, the problem there is that we can look at that from a negative perspective. There are two sides. God has allowed man freedom within His divine sovereignty. And God's providence does not take away from man's responsibility. But what we need to do, when we think in terms of God already
establishing what is going to be, what is going to be. What we need to do is just agree with God and go along with God. I don't know, these are deep thoughts and they're sometimes hard to get a hold of, but what he's saying is that whatever God determined your life to be, basically accept it as from God. Don't fight it. Someone said, oh, if you only knew what peace there was in an accepted sorrow. That is a profound statement. The same thing holds true. Oh, if we only knew what peace there was in accepting God's will for our lives, not fighting it. And then the whole idea of naming what God's going to do, he's going to do. You know that God is the one that gave names in the first few chapters of the book of Genesis? God called light, light. You ever think about that? Why do we call light, light? Who named it? God did. Why do we call darkness darkness? Where did darkness get its name? Darkness. Why not darkness? Why isn't darkness light and light darkness? Why is day called day and night is called night? The thing is that many people today, and this is why society is so screwed up, because they are not willing to accept what God has named. What God has said will be is going to be. But man, they fight it, they resist it, and they even go so far as to change the name for things that God has named. We've done that today with sin. God calls it adultery. We say, let's change that. Let's call it a fling. Let's call it affair. God calls it homosexuality. God calls it sodomy. Let's call it gay. I don't know where they ever got such a name for that lifestyle. It certainly isn't gay. And so we change the names to things that God has said. You know, if you really want to be happy and fulfilled and have a wonderful life, start accepting what God calls sin as sin. Start accepting what God says is obedience. That's the way to be happy. That's the way to find fulfillment. Not to just have some kind of a determined philosophy that, well, what's going to be is going to be, and you know, I'm just going to resist God and do my own thing, but accepting what God does. Truth is truth. There is absolute truth. If we do not accept what God calls sin to be sin and truth to be truth, and right to be right, wrong to be wrong, then we move into a world of illusion. The second question is at the end of verse 10, and Solomon says, why disagree with God? We cannot oppose him anyway and win. Why disagree with God? Why fight against God? Verse 10, at the end of that he says, neither may he, that is man, contend with him, that is God, that is mightier than he. You see that at the end of the 10th verse? First of all, what is going to be is going to be. And then secondly, why fight with God? He's mightier than us. We can't resist God. He's going to do what's best for us. Again, that's a negative view of the will of God. Solomon is giving us life under the sun. And it's wonderful to begin to see the will of God, whether we would call it good or bad, it's the will of God, as being good for us because God seeks only our highest good. Whatever God allows in our life, whatever God develops in our life, or whatever God allows to happen in our lives. We see it from the hand of God, and we see that God wills only what is best for us. We need to ask, what is God's will? And the way to freedom is to finding what God's will is and accepting it for our lives. It's like the little train that went out through the country and it saw the sheep playing in the pastures. And all he ever wanted to do was get off the tracks and play with the sheep. He was a train. He's made to go on the tracks, not to play out in the field with the sheep, you know. And then finally he jumped track and he got out in the field and he realized, oh, this is terrible. I'm not a sheep. I'm not made to be out here. I'm supposed to be running on the track. You see, man was made for God. Man was made to surrender to God and to fellowship with God. And you're off the track if you're not fulfilling what God has made you for and the purpose for which God created you for. The third question in verse 11
is what do we accomplish with all these words? Does talking about it solve the problem? The answer is yes and no. Verse 11, he says, seeing there be many things, and in the Hebrew the idea is words, many words, that increase emptiness, what is man the better? You know, there's so much talking today, and a lot of talking does not really produce light. Produces heat, no light, doesn't produce really any new understanding. I think of these universities where they have their debates and they have their philosophy rap sessions, you know, and they get in their little things and talk, and I mean, they don't come out the better. And so the answer to this is what we need is a word from God. What we need is to hear from God. It comes down to the idea again, too, that without a revelation from God, we are of all men most miserable, most to be pitied. What a wicked, horrible place this world would be if there were no word from God. And then we see the fourth question in verse 12, first part of verse 12. Who knows what is good for us? I like that. For who knoweth what is good for man in this life? You got that? What's the answer? God. Well, I know what's good for me. Yeah, I know what's good for me. And you make your plans and do your thing. And what's good for me is to do this and do that. Hey, you know who knows what's good for you? And you know who knows what's good for life? God does. That's why we tell young people who are kind of trying to decide what to do with their life, give it to God. Seek His will. Do His will. I want to be, fill in the blank. Is it according to the will of God? My goal, my ambition, fill in the blank. Is it according to the will of God? What does God want you to be? Even as parents, we should not try to force our children into our molds and what we want them to do and what we want them to be. Our goal in life should be for them to seek the will of God and to do it and obey it. What did Jesus say about the will of God? He said, my meat, King James for food, my food is to do the will of Him that sent me and accomplish His purposes and His plan in my life. That's really what Jesus said. My food is to do the will of Him that sent me. That's when you begin to live. That's when you begin to find life. That's when you begin to be fulfilled, is when you find God's will and you begin to do it. And then the fifth question in verse 12, at the end of the verse, does anybody know what life's or what's coming next? You see, Solomon wrestled with these questions. He wrestled with these questions of life. What's going to be is going to be. We can't argue with God. He's going to do it anyway. And what is God's plan for my life? And what are words really going to accomplish? Does anybody know what's coming next? He says in verse 12. He says, for all the days of his life are vain, which he spendeth in a shadow. For who can tell a man what shall be after him under the sun? The answer again is God. God knows the future. God knows what's next. I read an astounding thing. This one philosopher said this week. He wasn't a Christian, by the way. He said that there are three essentials for a person to find happiness in life. Something to do, someone to love, and something to hope for. Let me repeat those. Three grand essentials to happiness in life. Something to do, someone to love, and something to hope for. You know that as Christians, all three of those things we find in Jesus Christ. Something to do. My will is to do His will. My food is to do the will of Him that sent me. My life is given to do the will of God. We all have a goal and a purpose in life, serving God. Someone to love, that's easy. To love the Lord with all your heart and all your strength and all your mind and all your will. I have someone to love. I have a relationship with Jesus Christ. And the third thing is something to hope for. I mean, where do you find such a grand hope as the one we have in Christ? Outside of Christ, there is no hope.
We have a future. We have a hope. The grave doesn't end at all. Death isn't the end. There's a life beyond that grave. There's a future. There's a hope to look forward to. You know, if you go through whole life just miserable and trying to make ends meet, you never can. You know, life just seems to be passing you by, and every turn you take, it's a dead end street. You need to come to know the Lord and find out that you have someone to serve, you have someone to love and loves you, and you have someplace to go someday. You have a future, you have a hope. We have those three things in Jesus Christ. You know, you could title Ecclesiastes 6 and 7, "Don't judge life by its cover." You ever heard the phrase, "Don't judge a book by its cover"? But isn't that what we do? We're driving on the freeway and a guy goes flying by us in this really nice Lexus with a car phone, you know, and we go, "Ooh, look at that guy." Or maybe he's got some other kind of car that you're into. Or we see some person in the house, or we see some person on the screen, or we see somebody that's got what we wish we had, and we go, "Ooh," you know. Don't judge a book by its cover. Prosperity does not guarantee enjoyment. You see someone in chains, he's in prison, Roman guards are chained to his wrist, and you go, "Oh, poor fella, pity the soul." And then you get a little closer and you hear him say, "Oh, I'm content. My joy is complete." Matter of fact, when he wrote Philippians, he used the word joy no less than 19 times in 4 chapters. Don't judge a book by its cover. Don't judge life by its cover. Let's pray.